Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Inspired Evolution. And it is such a treat to be here today. Actually, a super treat because we're actually here for something super personal and super relatable, but something that we would normally perhaps avoid. So to join us on this episode, we've got Zenith Mirago. Zenith, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for making the time to be here. For those tuning in to Zenith for the first time, she's a marriage celebrant. She's a death walker, which we're going to talk about, and that's a very interesting term there. She's a consultant, educator, facilitator, speaker, and author. And a lot of her work these days is around the process of helping people grieve through death and dying. And it may sound a bit sober, but this is what we're going to talk about today. So welcome, Zenith.
Thanks. It's actually not sober at all. It's an incredible process to experience death or dying, especially sudden death, as fully as you can. So I hope that we can cover some of that today.
I think that's the mission, yeah. So this conversation was prompted because basically I lost a very dear mentor of mine, and she was, I don't know, it's hard to sort of describe someone as being taken before their time because, you know, some part of me believes that everybody comes and goes as their lessons sort of befit them. But I also lost a very dear pet in the same sort of window. And it sounds kind of ridiculous, you know, like some people find it a bit weird that, you know, the death of a pet means so much, but it really does. This pet was really dear to me. And so being surrounded by the loss of these two really, I guess, inspirational individuals that meant so much to me in my life. And I think with the culmination of perhaps maybe turning 30 had something to do with that as well. Just being a little bit more mature. In the past, I've lost people for sure. But I think my brain's been pretty good at compartmentalizing it and putting it off as something that I'm never really having to interface with it. But now it's starting to come home and hit home a little bit that actually there is this finality to everything. And it's been quite a surprising time for me personally. I've just come to realize that I don't actually, you know, perhaps process negative emotions as effectively as I thought I did. Even just the idea of sitting with, you know, the loss that was there that is ever so obvious at the moment is quite a profound day-to-day thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, death is a natural and sacred part of our lives. And I too would say that people can't die too soon. And, you know, none of us know what happens when someone dies. But most people seem to take comfort in that something lives on, something leaves the body. And it's my experience after you know, 25, 30 years in this work, you know, sitting with people at their bedside, sitting with families at the kitchen table, speaking to people at funerals and in public events and workshops, that, you know, the majority of people take comfort in that. They don't need to have a definitive perspective of what that is, you know, whether we become part of nature, whether we stay in some visual form, whether we become sort of ethereal. But most people take comfort in something leaves the body. And once you have an experience, and, you know, what you're saying about the death of your pet was, you know, maybe equally as profound for you as the death of someone else. You know, each death has an equation, and I would say this is the equation. So it depends on who that person is and how they die, or who that being is in the case of animals, and how they die, who you are and your relationship to them and your experience of death so far will give you a response to that particular loss or death. So it will be different every time. And so you might have the death of someone that's not so close to you now, and you'll be fine. You'll think, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And then the next one may be a different relationship, and the, you know, the response from you will be different. Mm. But the more familiar we become, the more resilience we have, until it's someone close to us or until it's a shocking or traumatic death. And then bang, you know, we will have a response that is more intense.
Yeah, it's fascinating that you mentioned that, because basically my mentor, she passed away with bowel cancer. And yeah, it was an interesting process to be a part of, because my relationship with her was relatively close, but it was more that she passed. And I sort of was latched onto the belief that she would make it through her treatment.
Yeah, so, and that's an attitude that a lot of people have when someone has a disease that is probably going to kill them. Sometimes it doesn't. Hmm. But what I'm advising people if people ask me in those situations, is that you need to set a place at the table for death in any of those experiences, because then, and put a bit of effort into imagining how that might be. And even though that might be a desired, undesired outcome, you can just give it a bit of thought and you can leave it alone. But if you plant that seed, then it will support you when that death comes. But if you put all your time supporting someone, yes, you can do it, this is going to be okay, you're not going to die, and all your attitude is in that, when they do die, then you have nothing to support you in that experience. You haven't practiced at all for that outcome. So you don't have to feed it, but you set a place for it at the table.
Yeah, there's an interesting, I really respect the way you're sharing that, because basically what came up for me was this person, a particular person, was very prominent in the community, and there was quite a few people saying their goodbyes before she had even passed. And I found that quite, I don't know, it rubbed me the wrong way a little bit. You just talked about leaving a space at the dinner table for death, and I think that's really profound, because, as you mentioned, I didn't have a lot of, I guess I didn't save any space for that. And so it does come a bit of a shock when that happens. The question that came to me was, there were a lot of people in her transitioning that were already starting to see her transition and started saying their goodbyes. And I found that a bit hard to deal with, just knowing what I know a little bit about the placebo, and how if people were saying their goodbyes before she had already crossed over, that was almost planting in her head that she was crossing over. And I felt there were so many people in her life already doing that, that I felt that actually she needs somebody at the very least to be there that's like, actually, I can't wait to see you, that is healthy and vibrant and radiant on the other side of all of this, and that there is a potential that you will actually make it through.
Yeah, and that attitude is a very common attitude, but you can hold the two.
Mm.
But if you don't, then you you know, you may have an influence on her journey.
Sure.
And that's what you're saying with, you know, what you might say is the placebo effect. But her journey is hers and yours is yours. And so if you were already watching other people, then you would just weigh that up. But you can only behave in the way that you can. So if you are just behaving like that for her, you have to look at, did that make it easier for you? Were you fully... were you starting to get ready for her to die? And if you were, but you weren't behaving on that, then you know you just have to listen to yourself and do the best you can, just like she's doing the best she can and the others were doing the best they can.
But yeah, so I think in hindsight, perhaps it was a bit foolish of me. But at the time I truly felt like I was operating in the best interest for both of
us. Sure, and it's a very common way of behaving for lots of people. With respect, you're quite young. Mm. And so if you look at that equation, that, the part of how you are, who you are, their relationship to you and your experience of death. So next time that occurs, you're going to look back and you're going to look back on that experience with her, and then you will behave however you choose to behave with that next person. But, it's a sort of disservice to the person not to say goodbye, and it's a sort of disservice to yourself. It's well-intentioned, but the outcome of that is what you're sitting in now. You know, and that's okay because it's a journey. You know, life's a whole journey. We're learning with each experience that life offers to us. And so, I'm in my 60s now with, a lot of death experience with friends, with family, with complete strangers. And so I'm very familiar with that. And so the way I approach it all is because of that familiarity, because of other people's experiences and their courage in facing their own death and their courage in facing the loss of someone that they love, especially with sudden death.
Mm. So that sort of segues into what I was going to ask you is like, you know, how did you become, what is a death walker and how did you become one?
So there are a range of terms. So I've spent the last 25, 30 years working with people in this area. So I live in Byron Bay in New South Wales.
Beautiful
which is,
part of the world.
And I would say, Byron's a great place to live, but it is a really great place to die because we have created a culture here that allows people to stay at home, be cared for. We know what our legal rights are. We know what our social rights are. We have a very empowered community in a lot of different fields. But I've become, in those last 25 years, I've become a very valuable community resource. And because we're a small town and a small area, there's Byron, Mullum, Bruns, and a bit further afield. Mm. So when someone's dying or someone has just died, then someone generally says to someone, let's ring Zenith. Let's ask her. She'll know the answer. Let's talk to Zenith. She'll know what we can do. Or that will make us feel better. So I spend a lot of time every day, bumping into people at the farmer's market, at parties, at the beach, wherever. And death's become a very discussable thing for us because it's become very normal because we can all be at the wedding, we can all be at the party, and then we're all at the funeral. And once a year I also put on a ceremony, a big community ceremony called the Day of the Dead. And people come to honour their dead. So that might be people who have died that year or over a longer period of time. And that has really, it's like a balm each year. And this year, last year we did it in November. And maybe 30 of the people that came said at the end when they had an opportunity to speak, they said, we are here because we didn't get to go to the funeral of whoever that was for them. And we feel like this is like coming to a ceremony for them.
Mm.
And really, I've just spent my entire time responding to what is asked of me. So I worked in law. I was a paralegal. I became a marriage celebrant and I became a death celebrant because a friend of ours died suddenly. And we took her after she'd had an autopsy, which is the legal, pretty standard thing if someone dies suddenly and a doctor can't sign off on the cause of death. She died suddenly and then we went to collect her body from the hospital. We took it home. We washed and dressed her. We drove her in our own car. We built a coffin. We allowed people to come to the home to have a sort of vigil and to spend time with her body. And then we drove it to the crematorium and we created a ceremony there. And then we pushed her coffin and her in that coffin that we had decorated. And it was an open coffin at the ceremony. And then we pushed her into the cremator. And so as a group of family and friends, for someone who died very suddenly, because we took charge of that process and we were involved at every step and we did everything we wanted to do. And in doing something, especially for men and women do it the same but sort of different, like we do everything the same but sort of different. And so we reclaimed that death process with her, and it really changed the way we've experienced her loss. So we were sad and we were shocked, but we felt empowered because we had given her the sort of ceremony that she would have wanted and that we needed. It was a meaningful and appropriate for her ceremony and for us. But also by washing and dressing her body, by placing it in the coffin ourselves, we really got to see that she was completely dead and that her body was empty. And whatever it was that had made her who she was, the body wasn't her. So a lot of people have a very sort of spiritual belief that, oh, they're not that body, you know, that we're spiritual beings in a human body. But we are very familiar with that body of that person. It's sort of what we relate to on a physical level, on an emotional level, is the person that, like, I'm talking to you, I'm seeing you by Zoom. Otherwise, I just could be talking to you in the ether, you know, on audio. But right. I'm relating to you because I can see you physically. So I have an idea of who you are.
Mm.
But if I didn't have that, my experience would be very different.
Sure.
So we become attached to the body. Mm. And so what happens for lots of people, especially, you know, what we call spiritual people, and when people use terms like transitioning or passing over, then and also the same with suicide, that we don't actually get that they are dead or they're dying. And so that doesn't land so strongly in us as using those words, because we all know what dead feels like. When someone's dead, they're not there. We don't know where they've gone, but all we're dealing with is that loss of them. We can wish them well on their journey, but we are dealing with the physical loss of that person in our lives. So we can still talk to their spirit. We can talk to their memory. Thoughts and love for them will arise in our response, but we miss them and it's the physical part of them that we miss. So if you can be with the body and in that washing, in that dressing, your mind starts to process and your emotions and your nervous system starts to really process that that person is dead. That body is there, but they are not that body. It's a sort of empty body. And children get it really quickly. So children will come to the person's body, they'll come to the coffin, and they'll look in and they'll you know, especially if there's a couple of them or if they're with a parent, and they'll say, oh, that's not Zenith. She's not there. And because they see the emptiness, they see that the body is not the person. And that it's a really great experience to have when you stand next to children saying that, because it really lands for you. And you think, you know, kids can, because kids see magic all the time. They're very easy to, but they feel things that are real. And we have a busy mind, so we're in our attachment to that person, which can be very, you know, we can, you know, what can we do? We can trick ourselves on an emotional level that we're attached to the body. But really, we should be wishing them well if we have a spiritual belief.
So it's fascinating. Like, even in this conversation, we've gotten deeper into the conversation of death than I have with a lot of people that I've spoken to in the past. And I think a lot of that has to do with somehow sitting here having this conversation with you. Palatable is an interesting word, but the conversation around death is, it's not as chunky while you and I are talking. I'm acutely aware of this. And my next question that immediately arises from that is, you know, there's also this Odian sort of connotation or belief or stigma, I think is probably the right word, around the idea that, like, you know, if you're consistently thinking about death, it's somewhat morbid, and that, you know, it's just like it's a dark sort of space to be in. But speaking to you, there seems to be very little darkness. And I think it's my question is more, how do you not let death get to you, if that is the question? Or is it like, you know, yeah, that sort of conventional idea of like death and the darkness and all the negative thoughts. Like, I'm sure that's pretty common for people.
I do let death get to me, but not in the way that you are talking about. So death gets to me, and what it has done to me because of my familiarity with it, because of the amount of people I have been with when they were dying and being with their families or being with sudden death, what it's done is it's really polished me into something much more beautiful than I could have imagined. And what I have now is a sort of spontaneous joy that arises. So we all have a response to loss, and based on that equation that we discussed at the beginning. But then what happens is, for me, is I hear that news that someone's died and I'm sad for a moment. And my body might cry depending on my relationship to that person. But then almost immediately I have this sort of this joy arise. It's a bit like, you know, when you're walking down the street and you see an old friend that you're not expecting to see, someone that you really love, you know, that feeling, how that arises in you, and you're just like, ah, I didn't, you know, and it's sort of, you can't fake that. You can't pretend that joy at seeing that person. And it's a similar quality that arises in me. So what I would say is that those experiences over a long period of time have...
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I have created a response that is a true acceptance and an immediate acceptance that they have died They have transitioned into some other form, but it's not an intellectual perspective or an intellectual understanding, which I think a lot of people try to have, but they don't actually have embodied in their response. So my embodied response now allows me to be with people, even when I'm sitting with parents of dead children who have died suddenly. And so even recently in the last 3 weeks, a young couple here had a baby. The baby was breech and the baby died because the mother could not deliver that baby, and the baby was coming and they weren't prepared for a breech, and they weren't prepared for they didn't have someone there to deliver that baby. So the baby died. So I went to be with them. Now, that is a very shocking experience for them, very sad. And they were very upset, and they had to deal with the police and the ambulance and everything. But what happens for me is I come neutral to that experience. I wait and see what is happening. So I don't bring my own shit, my own emotional baggage to that. I come clean. I come kind, I come present, and I come neutral. And then I respond to because that is their loss. So I don't overlay it with my distress that they have had a stillborn baby. I come and I offer them whatever I can in that experience. So that might be comfort. That might be something like a life raft in a choppy sea. That might be love. That might be legal knowledge, and that's exactly what was the most needed from me in that experience. And so I don't find death morbid. It can be sudden. It can be shocking. It can be traumatic. But the most important thing I'm finding now after a lot of years is that the language we use around it, and so especially for someone like you, who obviously is, you know, a thinking, feeling person, but you really want to, and this goes to everybody, I'm talking to you, but anybody who's listening to this, just think about how you use that language, how you bandy it around, and try to temper that with what you actually mean, rather than just using language that is common but doesn't necessarily pertain to exactly what you're talking about. So even when, so when I say sudden or shocking, I don't mean traumatic. When I say traumatic, I mean traumatic. And they're very different experiences. And so I find that by using the best language, the most appropriate language with people, that can also offer them a hand to take them from one place to another. And so often I'm what Americans call a first responder. So I am often one of the first people they are talking to, either while they're dying or when that death has occurred. And I come to that and offer the cleanest, best assistance I can. And so I don't say anything that I don't mean or that I haven't thought about, but now that language just arises. So once you start throwing words about, and this is not an attack on you, this is just, you know, think about it for everyone, is once you start banding words about, like, grief even, because some people are happy someone has died. So sometimes I go to families, you know, the parent has died, and I go and sit at the kitchen table, and I, you know, I don't go in there and say, I'm sorry for your loss, which most people think is a pretty safe starting point. But I say, how is that for you? And I say that because I mean it. You can't just say it glibly, oh, and how is that for you that your mum or your dad has died? But sometimes people say, well, actually, you know, we're really glad they're dead. They've made our life a misery for the last 50 years. They were selfish. They were unkind. They were cruel. And I sit there and go, oh, okay. And then we proceed from there. But if I go in thinking, oh, it must be terrible, I'm so sorry that your dad's died or your mum's died.
Yeah, you tainted it with your own frame.
You're overlaying it. So you want to see what's happening so you can respond accordingly. But you don't, and even if that is, you know, even with children. So sometimes I go to families and a small child has died and it's shocking and it's sad. And sometimes the circumstances are traumatic. But sometimes I will say, you know, I will just sit with them. I will be with them. I will walk that journey with them. But I cannot take that pain away. And it's their right to feel that pain. That is their love transformed. And if someone tries to make that better or tidy it up, they cannot have that process fully. But and they need, you know, they need to feel their love for that child. But sometimes they'll say things like, well, you know, they came to us, we loved them up as much as we could. We couldn't stop the circumstances of that death. They didn't contribute towards that in any way. So they are just in the fact that that child is gone. And sometimes if they have a strong belief, they will fit, they will be, okay is not quite the right word, but they will be able to bear that. So a lot of people say around death of children, oh, my God, that must be unbearable. Well, if you label it unbearable, that doesn't offer people the chance to bear it.
Yeah, right.
But the parents do have to bear that pain. And so you want to, you know, you want to be kind to them. You don't want to, you know, add to their distress, add to their sorrow that they are in right now. So it's much more complex than that, but it's sort of, that's the simple way of being with it. So as a death walker, what I'm walking towards my own death the best I can. And I'm also walking with other people who invite me to experience their journey with them. But it's not my place to deny them that pain. I might ease it in some way. But, you know, we all know that some of the great challenging things in our life are the things that teach us the most. And we're doing that from as small children. You know, we're climbing that tree and we're hanging on and we're reaching that little bit extra to get our little fingers around the next branch or to find a place for our foot. And sometimes we fall. But if we don't attempt to climb that tree and go beyond our capacity or what we think is our capacity, we don't learn and we don't see what we're capable of. And we don't then have that sense of, wow, you know, that was a big learning. Wow. Or I won't be climbing that tree again. Or, you know, but sometimes, you know, life is full of opportunities. And the more we take them fully and the more we practice and experience what it has to offer us, then the more rich our lives become and the more capable we become. And all the small losses will prepare us for the big ones.
Yeah, I think that's profound. And what you're sharing has definitely been, thank you so much for sharing. I think something that is really true is just even in the process of sitting with the death of others, it's really gotten me really clear on just my own relationship with life, or clearer, if we can, like knowing that, you know, there is a finality to, you know, even this experience, which is so wonderful, and realizing what it is that I really want to experience while I'm here, you know, and what it is that I really want to contribute. The word legacy comes to mind every now and then as well.
Yeah, which are big thoughts for someone so young. That's great. But, you know, I have a couple of things that are helping me, and I just think, When life offers me something, I think, will this help me at the time of my death? And will this matter at the time of my death? So it really helps you not to sweat the small stuff.
Yeah.
So you know, and you might take a stand on something, you know, you might be on a principle, you might think it's important, you might be arguing with someone, and you might feel satisfied because you're right and you've won the point. And then you just think, actually, will this matter to me if I don't have a friendship with that person? And sometimes it will influence how you behave. It really starts to polish what's important and what isn't.
Mm. Thank you. So my question that comes out of there is, you know, for some people, I'm sure having interfaced with so many people over so many years, you must have met some people with a variety of range of, emotions, in their process of passing away. So is there, you know, some people must fear death and some people must be somewhat okay with it. Is there something you can tell us more about that process for individuals, like themselves when they're passing away? So less about people and their loved ones, but more about individuals' relationships with their death, and anything that stands out for you that's remarkable in that?
Well, people can only do what they are capable of.
Mm.
And most people try to experience life as fully as they can. But a lot of people don't. You know, they're sort of living a half life, or they're afraid to live fully for whatever reason.
Mm.
So I would, as a general statement, I would say that people who are afraid to live will generally be afraid to die. But the exception to that is when life has been really harsh for them, and sometimes people are relieved that they are going to die. They're like, right, I can accept that. That's a relief. I don't have to make any more decisions. Life, I won't suffer so much. I won't have to worry about the mundane. And so some people are overcome by this like deep relaxation, this deep acceptance. And other people think that might be denial.
Mm.
So some people, and denial is a really tricky concept or a piece of language that you take on or can overlay on a situation. So some people are not in denial. They know they're going to die, but they do not want to discuss it. They do not want everybody's sympathy they don't want everybody else's shit coming in their direction.
Mm.
They're busy. So what I would say as a sort of absolute for me is that it doesn't matter what the external circumstances are. They will contribute to that experience. It doesn't matter the people you have. It doesn't matter, you know, if you've got a nice view. It doesn't matter if you're at home or in hospital or even on the side of the road after a car accident or a motorbike accident. What really matters is what is happening for you or for anybody else on the inside. So there's a sort of cliche that death's an inside job or happiness is an inside job. Mm. And I would absolutely support that, because I see people who they may be in physical suffering and I would advocate for pain relief. And a lot of people here are concerned that if they take a high dose of a painkiller that they won't be present, they won't have a conscious death, whatever that might be for them. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's very hard to have a conscious death when you are in physical pain, extreme mm-hmm. physical pain. So for those of us that are women who have birthed, then we know that in order to birth that baby, we generally are going to experience some physical pain,
but it's
going to be worth it in the end. We're going to deliver that baby, and that's that. And so death often will be accompanied by pain, but it shouldn't be excruciating. And if you have medication or some therapeutic thing that can help you with that, great, because then. But at the same time, I cannot believe, I don't know, but I cannot believe that drugs like morphine or any of the heavy-duty ones affect the spirit. They have they affect the mind.
Yep.
They might dull the mind, and they will assist the body with its pain.
Mm.
But it just doesn't make any sense to me, with everything that I experience, that drug will affect the spirit.
Yeah.
Because we cannot even define it. No mm. one's in agreement what it is. Some people, you know, you can call it what you will.
Mm.
But, and so, because some people who are dying are sort of in a coma sort of state, they're unconscious, they're sleeping a lot, they're pulling in, everything is pulling in order to go out. That's what I see. And some people will be resistant to dying, some people will be fearful of dying, some people will be without fear, and then some people die with grace. And when you experience that, when you sit with someone who in their dying process, which may be, you know, 2 or 3 months, when they are dying with grace, they offer you such an incredible teaching. They offer you such an incredible transmission that you are never the same. That happened to me, must be 20 maybe 15, 20 years ago now, a young guy was dying. I spent the afternoon with him, and I was never the same after that, because he taught me something. And once I knew that was possible and I could feel it by being with him, that it meant for me that that was the only way to go, because it's the best way to go for the person. And it's by far the best way to go for the people who will live on.
Right,
it's an incredible transmission of generosity, of grace, and that will make their experience, when they walk on into their lives without that person physically in it, they won't collapse. They won't be distraught. They'll be sad and they'll feel a range of things, but they will not be destroyed by that loss of that person, because they have been walking towards that moment as well as they can. Mm. But when someone is gracious, and if anybody's listening to this who's had that experience, often what happens is people start to smile, because that feeling spontaneously re-arises in them. And just like it's sort of arising in me, it's a memory, but it's more than that. It's an embodied experience. And that sustains me through a lot of other more tricky experiences. But people can only do their best. So the whole concept of a good death can be really challenging when it's a struggle for people. And, you know, we shouldn't be putting that measure on them. The better measure is to die well, whatever that might look like for them.
Mm. That's profound. Thank you so much for sharing that. And so you've got your book, which is The Intimacy of Death and Dying. A book recently that I was exposed to was also a book written by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, The Five Stages of Grief, she mentions, which are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
So let me just speak to that, because I have never read that book.
Yep.
But it's sort of like Kubler-Ross wrote that book, it was groundbreaking work at its time. It really opened up. She was part of that first wave of people trying to wake people up to doing death differently, to doing it well.
Mm.
But I think if you read that book, those five stages were, this is my understanding, I haven't read it, those five stages are also for the people who are accompanying that person.
That individual. That was going to be my question.
Rather than the dying person. But I'm sure the dying person does have some of those stages, but or some of those experiences. But I don't think you can take it as an absolute, you know, you pass through this, then you're in that, then you work with that, and then you pass through that. They offer themselves as experiences, but some people will just get that in one go.
Mm.
They'll just go, okay, And, you know, when you sit with someone who's at peace with their dying, because if you're a 25-year-old person and you've just had a young baby and you get diagnosed with something that is going to kill you, then, and, you know, you can try all the treatment that you want, and then you're still looking at death. You have a right to be, you know, really angry about that, you know, but that anger is pain. It is hurt. It's a whole lot of things, but it manifests as anger. Mm. Whereas if you're 85, you've lived a long life, you've done what you wanted to do, you've been maybe in a happy relationship, you know, you've done what, whether you have children or not, whether you've traveled or not, whether you've had a career or not, whether you've had a relationship or not, you know, then it's, I would say that you look back and you think, well, I've lived that life. And it can be easier then if you've lived a long time. But some people are very gracious even when they're young. And often people who work with children who have a disease and who are dying will say that the children have this incredible wisdom that which may appear to be way beyond their years.
Mm.
But often they're not so attached, and they don't, you know, they're not clinging on often. They're just, you know, a lot of kids will accept what's happening because that's part of their experience so far. So you can't blanket them all in the response of the person or the response of the people accompanying them, the left behind.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you. And so you said you often ask yourself, like, will this matter in the face of death or at the time of death? Like, will this, like, will whatever, and that becomes really clarifying in terms of, you know, not sweating the small stuff. Do you sometimes find yourself surprised at what people do sweat?
I wouldn't say I find myself surprised with that, although I probably have been. But I very, even in my own life, as opposed to my professional life, I'm very rarely surprised. It takes a lot to surprise me because I'm so open to all possibilities, and I try to be neutral. Mm. So I'm not in the past and I'm not in the future. I'm in the now. And so whatever's coming, I'm just like, wow, okay, rather than wow, you know. But occasionally I say, wow, that's a surprise. I didn't see that coming. Mm. So I am, but very rarely with death, I have to say now.
Mm. Yeah, the question was more oriented towards life. Like, do you sometimes feel surprised that people are, you know, oftentimes, I guess we spend a lot of time doing things that perhaps wouldn't enrich our experience at the dying moment.
Oh,
we spend most of our life doing things like this. So does that kind of,
Yeah, but I suppose the longer I'm in my 60s now, I've lived a long time. I've lived a very full and fabulous life, I might add. And, you know, I've lived also since I was 16 when my best friend died suddenly because of the neglect of the hospital when we were young. I have lived most of my life thinking that I could die tomorrow, and not in just, you know, in a thought way, but I've lived that in an embodied way. Well, I could be dead tomorrow. So it's made me say yes to lots of things, not to worry about them. So it's a bit like you. You asked me if I would do this. I just say yes. I don't, you know, we didn't have much of a talk beforehand. We launched straight into it. We had a problem with the technology, we just carry on. We don't make a big fuss.
Yeah.
And so what it has given me is this incredible ability to roll with what's there and what's there and what's there. The Buddhist definition of suffering is to want something to be something other than it is.
Yeah. And the distance between the truth and what your desire is for it to be. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not busy with anything that isn't there. I don't sweat that. Sometimes I'm there, sometimes it's a disaster, sometimes it's so shocking. But I am in that I'm present to that to the best of my ability, because what I am is I have a, you know, incredible amount of things that I can offer as a resource. And sometimes what I have to offer is to be silent, is to just be quiet, is to just sit with that person, not even hold their hand, not embrace them. And as a woman, I can generally, you know, embrace people from a neutral place. It's a much safer thing to be doing rather than with some other people. So, but sometimes I just sit with them and I bear witness to their suffering and I honor that suffering, because I see that that is their love transformed. And if that process gets interrupted or tidied up or shortened or stifled, then it may take them longer to come to a place of okayness in that, a place of acceptance, a place of being with what is, rather than how they wanted it to be. Or in the so shock is another thing, and trauma is a condition where sort of trauma 101 is too much too soon. So sometimes people will see someone die in an accident, and that I would say is a traumatic experience. Or they will be, you know, chatting away with their friends, and then they'll pick up the phone and someone will say, someone's just died, and that person is very close to you. And so what happens then is sometimes your nervous system will go into shock.
Yep.
And that's very, you know, so it's the subtlety of the response and how that person hears that news, or what they bear witness to. Or so a lot of people have sudden death and then they have to deal with the police. And that compounds that distress. So sometimes what I'm bringing to that is an unraveling, a sort of pulling out of the experience with the police and returning to the experience of the death. And not be, you know, and letting that, seeing that as separate and putting it over there, but coming back into their, what they're actually feeling about the loss of that person or that person's death. Does that all make sense?
It does, yeah. Something that really got to me was, is probably an interesting word, but you refer to it as love transformed.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit?
So because I've spent the last 25 years of my life marrying people and burying people and farewelling them assisting people to be with that person while they're dying, whatever. So I see that nearly all of my work is about love. So for example, I only eat and I'm able to pay my bills and make a living if someone loves each other themselves enough to talk to me while they're dying, someone else loves them enough to give them a funeral, or they love someone else enough to want to get married. So all of my work is really funded by love. And I would say that because it's true.
Yeah.
And I would say that after about 10 years of that work. But then after about another 15, about another five on top of that, so about 15 years into that work, I realized that what people were feeling was their love. Because if you hear about the neighbor down the road who's just died, even if that's in shocking circumstances, like they were on the zebra crossing and a car came along and killed them. Now you hear that news and you say, oh, that's terrible. But it doesn't touch you in a deep emotional response, right? You're just shocked at the news and you might be sad that they are dying. But if you care for that person, which goes back to that original, it just goes back to that original equation of how it affects you. Is it what you're saying with your pet? Or, and what was her name?
The lady that passed away, or my pet?
Both. If your pet was a good.
Brutus was the name of my pet, and Bava was the name of my mentor.
Yeah. So if you have an emotional connection to them, you will then have an emotional response to that. But if you love them, then you're gonna have a really big response. It doesn't mean it can go in any direction, but the love you feel for them in that moment of their dying or of their death, it will transform into some other emotion, like despair, gratitude, inspiration, abandonment. It can, there's a whole range of emotions, but you only feel those really if you love someone. And love and fear are the sort of same things. Hate is an aspect of love. So I'm not a spiritual teacher. I haven't got that all down. Yeah. I'm only speaking from my own experience of being with people, and they're just regular people. Mm-hmm. But what I do see is if people know, so if I'm with people who are dying and I can only ask them one question because they don't have much strength and they don't, and the kindest thing to do is not to grill them. So I don't ask, I don't care what they're dying from, that I have nothing to contribute to their medical condition or the treatment of that condition. I don't even ask them what they're dying from or the people around them. But what I do ask them is, what do you believe happens when you die? And the answer to that is an incredible resource to the people, other people in the room, or when I retell that at the funeral ceremony, then that will sustain people. So if people say, I believe that I'll become, I'll become a butcher bird, or, oh, I'm going to become part of everything, or I'm going to be watching out for you. I'm always going to be there. I'm going to be dancing on the top of the mountain. I'm going to be in everything. Then I'm going to be in the rainbows. And so you can imagine then every time you see one of those things or you feel that experience, you're going to say, oh, there she is. And so that brings a lot of comfort to people, but it also allows them to have a resource, because most people believe in something, and you can watch people when they explain to you what they believe in, even though none of us know, you can watch them. It sort of fills them up, and it's, even if it is a placebo, which is what you were saying at the beginning, we all know that placebo works sometimes, depending on what the condition is. A placebo sometimes can't reverse a disease, but it can assist the person to feel better.
So I have a question. We've spoken a lot about death and walking with death. Any advice you have for those that are, because in one way or another, we're actually all walking towards our death from the moment we're born.
We are.
In many ways, in every way, actually. And so any advice for, those that are conscious that they're walking towards their death?
Yeah, I think whether you're conscious or not, I mean, we all know that we're born and we're going to die. We don't know when that death will occur. So we don't know the time and place unless we choose to kill ourselves, and then we will know the time and place and we have some control over that. So, but most of us want to live, and that death will occur sooner or later. But I really do think that the best thing you can do is live that as fully as possible and explore on an internal level and sort of set a place for death at your table. And it sounds like a trite thing, but for example, when I die, I could die tomorrow. I do a lot of things that could cause my death. And I travel a lot. So even if I die when I'm overseas, even if I'm murdered overseas, which would not be my preference, but there's a possibility, because I travel to America, and when I come back, I always say, wow, I feel really lucky I never got shot in America. So I feel like I've won lotto because I didn't get shot in America. But what will happen when I die? And I'm very loved. I have a lot of great friends. I have a community that really loves me within this community. People are going to say, wow, she really lived that life. And she was as familiar as possible with death. And I won't have any regrets when I die. And so that, because I've lived my life well, that will support them in their love for me when I die, regardless of how I die. They will have to. They'll feel their feelings of sadness, but no one is going to be distraught when I die because it's life. And so I say yes to what life offers me unless I get a big body no. I don't spend a lot of time now wanting it to be some other way. So whatever presents itself, whatever rolls in, I just am with. But a lot of things, a bit like in the ocean, when a huge wave is coming, you can't stop that wave. So you can either dive under it and come up, or you can turn to the side and let it smash past you. But you don't just stand there and let it hit you like that. You work with it. And so, and the opposite of that is you can be a great surfer. So you can have all the tools to live your life. But if the ocean doesn't offer you a wave, it's flat, you don't get to be a great surfer. But you know that you're a good surfer. You know you're just having a flat day. So the best you can do is prepare for that, is to, and I asked the Dalai Lama this once many years ago. I said, what can people do so that when we die, the people left behind don't hurt so much? And his response was, if you live a good life, if you live the best you can, it's almost impossible for them they might hurt for a moment like I do now where I'm sad.
But they'll remember you with quickly, a smile.
Yeah, that quickly transforms because not only a smile, but you can feel that person throughout your heart. It's an embodied experience of love that you have experienced with that person, and that will arise.
I love that. It's almost like you owe it to your loved ones to live your life well in a way. So that's, yeah.
Yeah, you don't owe it to them.
You owe it to yourself, really.
That's right. But that is the fallout from that, or that is a consequence of that.
That's brilliant.
So really, you owe it to people, loved ones, and even people you don't know, and the planet, everything, to live not just as fully as you can, but as well as you can in cooperation with others, to be kind. To be considerate, to live as sustainably. We can all behave badly, but then you own it. But it doesn't matter what's happening around you, it's all on the inside. And it's a life's journey to become the best person that you can be, and to live that life as well as you can, and to be of benefit to others. Not just for your own. I mean, people can accumulate lots of wealth and money, but a lot of them are empty. They're trying to fill up a void of emptiness on the inside because they don't have a fullness. But you don't have to own anything to have a fullness.
That's brilliant.
You only have to, own your own life and really to, it's the Monty Python, the meaning of what's the meaning of life? Who knows? Who cares? Who cares? It's such an incredible experience.
Yeah, I love that.
To be a human being is just such an extraordinary experience, to be in a functioning, healthy body, especially as an adult with the amount of things you can fully experience as an adult. As children, you can experience lots of wonderful things and lots of terrible things, and the same as an adult. But But if we have a functioning mind and nervous system and emotional responses, we're very fortunate because not everyone has that. Sure. So I don't know.
So my last, I'm slowly getting to the end. I know I'm just so engrossed in our conversation here. One question off the topic of death is, you've mentioned this quite a bit, and actually I set an intention for this year, is kindness. What does kindness mean to you?
Well, I think we all know what kindness feels like. We know what it feels like when someone is kind to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what it feels like when we are kind to others. And it can be something very small.
Usually is.
So generally, I very rarely use the word compassion, which goes back to the thing about language, because I don't really know what compassion means. But I really don't know what it feels like. But I know what, I can open the door for someone. I can pick something up that they've dropped. I can pick up a hitchhiker and go a little bit further than where they need to go to make that easier for them. Mm. And I can do it. It's so easy. And I have a baseline where I just have to make a difference for one person a day.
Mm.
And it's a good day. And it's very easy to achieve that.
Mm.
And so sometimes I do something for someone and I think, wow, if I don't do anything all year, that was such a big assistance to them. For example, when people, get their baby back from their baby who's died back from the hospital, because I understand the law involved in that.
Mm.
And when I see what a difference that makes to the parents, then I just think, oh, that's a good day. Mm. You know, and then I carry on with my day. But kindness, I think, so I would encourage people to sort of, unless you are practicing Buddhist or you're practicing, you know, serious religious practitioner or whatever, and you really get what compassion is, great. But for regular people like us, and probably like most of the people listening, then my currency is kindness. So I'm trading in kindness every day, all day, and the rewards internally and externally and in ways that I never even know, in the ripple out effect, are boundless. But so the thing about kindness is it's a win for everyone. It's a win for the person, the kinder and the kindee, you know, whatever the phrase is for that. But we all know, and years ago I married this couple who I'm still friends with. I didn't know them before I married them. And they had this as their wedding, one of their wedding vows. I promise, when you're not feeling well, to be kind to you and look after you. And everybody at that wedding went, oh, when they heard that, because it landed in them. They all knew what it felt like to be unwell and for someone to be kind to you. And so it's much better to be doing something that you can feel, that you can embody, that has an embodied response in the giving and the receiving, than some conceptual compassion. Good on compassion. I don't want to knock it.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. Direct experience of,
kindness is an incredible currency. It doesn't cost you, well, it costs you something, but the return is so great.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. And so, just closing up now, a question that I'm wanting to ask you now is, what do you believe happens when you die?
I don't actually have a belief. I don't. And so, because I'm busy right now living as fully as I can, but I only have one practice. I don't meditate. I don't do a whole lot of things. I'm living my life fully. But this is my only practice, which is to be with what is and to see the perfection of everything as it unfolds rather than in retrospect. so that when I die, I don't miss it. So basically, I haven't spent 25 years on that coal face for something that I know will come, but I don't know how it will come. So if I am present to that, so all the time, so if I'm driving along, I'm present to the fact that something could wipe me out at any moment. A car could jump the light, come around the corner, anything, because I do not want to miss that moment of death. Because it will only be then that I will get the answer to that question. Mm. And so I'm compelled to, I sort of believe a certain thing because from other people's experience and what they have told me and what they have experienced. But from a physics point of view, you know, nothing becomes nothing, it transforms into energy.
Something.
Sure. Transforms into something. But I don't want to miss it. And I gave a paper a little while ago which was about death and sex, which is another whole topic. But basically the French, as you probably know, call orgasm the small death.
Yeah, mini death.
That's right, la petite mort. And I gave a paper which said if orgasm is the small death, is death the total body orgasm? And when the body knows it's dying, it releases endorphins. So a lot of people are with someone in the room and suddenly that person who's been, sleeping a lot will suddenly sort of wake up, be fully present, look at people, sometimes speak, but be totally there. And the room will flood with an energy. And then the person will fall back and die. Or sometimes they don't wake up, but suddenly at the moment of death, people in the room will go, can you feel that? Can you feel that? Because the endorphins that the brain is releasing are surging into the body. But just like testosterone and other hormones, they exude out of the body. You know how you can smell testosterone? You can taste it when someone's like pumped up and full of it. Yeah. And it's the same. So the human body is so amazing that and women's body is so amazing for birthing, but we are all geared, our bodies are made to die. Mm. And it comes as no surprise to me when I found that out. That was a possibility. So I don't want to miss that moment. How would anybody would have missed that moment? So my whole life is a practice for that moment of being present. Okay?
I think that's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. So for those want to tune into Zenith Virago, how do they get in touch with you? What's the best way? Is it to get a copy of your book or is it to reach out to you somewhere? How do people find you? I know you've got a beautiful website.
Yeah, so I have a small charity which is called the Natural Death Care Center, and we're part of that global movement for offering services for people or just information really, as well as education. So I teach a three-day, most of the time now I spend traveling and teaching about death and dying for people who want to enhance their already existing skills or wake up their capacity because we all have the inherent capacity to die well. And so, but some people just want to wake it up. And some people feel they have a calling. I wouldn't say I have a calling, but some people do feel that. So, you can look online, the Natural Death Care Center. There's a small independent documentary that some people from America made called Zen and the Art of Dying, which, is interesting. There's the book. But really, the biggest resource people have is themselves. And, so look at your language, say yes to what life offers you, especially if it's around death, and put yourself into those experiences, not in an obtrusive way, but in a gentle and kind way, and start to become familiar and look at things that may be challenging. And try your best to increase your capacity a little bit every day.
Mm.
So, but I think everyone has the inherent capacity to do death well.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And my last question, and by no means my least question, it's esoteric in its nature. Zenith, beyond death, beyond life, beyond the name, beyond the work that you do, who are you?
I am someone, I'm a woman. I love being a woman. I'm a woman who is living the best life I can live. I'm having the most amount of experiences I can have whilst being of benefit to others. And I, you know, I don't know. I probably think that we're spiritual beings having a human experience, and but the human body is so capable of so much pleasure and joy, and so I'm very busy having a joyful, kind, rewarding, exciting, adventurous life, and every day I swim in the ocean every day. You know, I engage with people, I say yes to invitation. My life's been more than I could possibly have imagined.
Incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that. And thank yous. I really want to thank you for being here today, taking the time and the energy to really sit here with me, process through some of my stuff, but also help others with the journey of death. And, you know, it is something that is somewhat taboo in our culture. And just I love the energy that you bring
taboo.
Around.
Taboo. Scrap yeah. taboo out of your vocabulary.
That. Yeah.
That's because you're perpetuating a concept that is not helpful.
At all. Yeah, and so just even the energy with which how clean and how easy it was to talk to you about this was really helpful. And so I don't just want to thank you for today. I also want to thank you for, you know, the past, you know, like the 10, 15, 25 years. I know you don't spend a lot of time thinking about the past, but also just showing up along all those little moments, you know, to inform the conversation and the person that you are today so that we can have this really nourishing conversation for the listeners. So thank you for that. And just wishing you all the best with the future ahead and everything that's coming your way.
Thank you. And I have to say that when I come to this conversation, we all come to this conversation, all the people who I've worked with, who I've, you know, traveled that journey of death and dying with. And, you know, we all come to offer you this conversation, not just me. It's an embodied, it's an embodiment of all of those experiences.
I feel really honored to have that conversation today. Thank you so much.
Great. You're welcome.
Hey tribe, thanks for tuning in to another fun, enlightening episode of The Inspired Evolution. I've been loving all the feedback and personal stories of love, health and growth. Your feedback and stories are incredibly welcome. The easiest way to connect with me is via my website, which is www.amrit-sandhu.com. You can leave me a message or a comment. It's one of my highest values to connect, so I love to connect and love to hear from you. You can also find me on Facebook, Amrit Sandhu. And if the content has been resonating with you, you can help The Inspired Evolution out in a big way by liking the YouTube channel, subscribing to The Inspired Evolution, or the Facebook page, like that please, at The Inspired Evolution, or by leaving a review on iTunes if you're on an Apple device. And also, if The Inspired Evolution episodes are inspiring an evolution within you, or you can feel the inspiration is valuable for your team to evolve to the next level, you can head on over to www.amrit-sandhu.com to see how The Inspired Evolution can help you and your team thrive. Much love, tribe.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.